balances the reality that it can't renew its entire self like some parts of the body can. That's because, as your ardent protector, your liver can become extremely scarred and damaged over time, with cells destroyed by pathogens and other troublemakers. As you've heard, nobody's liver is running at 100%. The damage that occurs to the liver from neglect and misunderstanding is unlike the damage that occurs anywhere else in the body. Though some damaged liver tissue can still be in limited working order and able to be partially renewed, the liver can't renew much, if any, of the severely damaged tissue if someone's not actively working on it. This is what makes the number 9 resonate and what gives the liver that heavy, boulder-like quality of standing still through time. The profound part has to do with the liver's unique ability to renew the good parts of itself on a specific schedule in order to sustain life. Its responsible timekeeping in this area is unlike anything else in the body. The physical state that you're in, your body's resources, your toxic load, and so on, that list of factors from the beginning of this section, they make or break renewal in other body parts. With your liver, renewal happens, period. It's something you can rely on, as surely as you can rely on your birthday rolling around on the same day each year. Your liver renews all its healthy cells completely within each 9-year mark of your life. It's not one big, continuous, everyday state of renewal, though some cell renewal can happen on an ongoing basis. The liver renews itself in thirds over those 9 years. Usually, 3 months before a 3-year mark is when renewal will pick up speed and the liver will work on a fast, serious cell overhaul. Within just those few months, the liver can regenerate a third of its working cells. The same thing will happen again at the next 3-year mark, renewing another third of the liver. And then, as it approaches 9 years total, the liver will renew its final third for that cycle. It's the same timetable for everyone. It happened for us all as we approached our 3rd birthday, our 6th birthday, and our 9th birthday. And then the cycle started over and continued and will continue for the rest of our lives. This means that any kindnesses you pay your liver around those special birthdays that are multiples of 3 will give it an extra boost as it works to bring new life to itself. If you were born premature and underdeveloped, you have a few months to play with after each multiple of 3 birthday. Here's a really important point. Just because they're new cells doesn't mean they're clean. If you're not pulling out troublemakers in between those birthdays, new cells can get contaminated by cells and poisons of the past. That's how toxins can stick around in your liver for decades. It's also why it's vital to cleanse troublemakers. Like viruses and heavy metals on an ongoing basis throughout your whole life. And as we discussed, the cell renewal timetable doesn't mean that liver damage and disease and scar tissue go away after 9 years if you're not actively working on healing them. If you create a great lifestyle for your liver, though, and do everything right for it using the resources in this book, you have hope of this renewal cycle reviving injured tissue. As these special birthdays approach, think about letting them remind you to do a little more. In the lead-up to your 27th birthday, or your 36th, or your 48th, or your 54th, or your 60th, or your 75th, or your 81st, or your 99th, or any of the threes before, after, or in between, think about sipping some more green juices, eating a little less fat, getting more hydrated, and bringing in more antioxidant-rich foods such as fruit. And any time in between that you do the Liver Rescue 369 or the Liver Rescue Morning from Chapter 38, you help secure the possibility of your liver's cells replacing themselves properly so you can feel your best. Ox bile. A fairly recent trend based on myth is to take the bile from an ox, encapsulate it, and use it as a supplement for people with digestive problems. The theory seems right, practically flawless. We have trouble breaking down fats, and our own bile is potentially being underproduced. So the magic remedy must be some nice, strong ox bile, right? Wrong. Why is this a myth? Because the human liver doesn't like it. If your liver could speak aloud in our language, it would say, "Stop putting another creature's bile inside our body! Halt!" Taking ox bile doesn't fix the problem of weak digestion. It doesn't fix the problem of your liver being stagnant or sluggish or underproducing its own bile. One of your liver's birthrights is to produce and control bile levels. This information is stored inside of it, and it keeps your liver programming and reprogramming itself to give you life for as long as it possibly can. Taking away that responsibility from your liver is like taking away your right to choose how much food you eat. What if you were completely stuffed, yet had no right to stop food from being put in your mouth? What if you were forced to chew and swallow even though your stomach's capacity was already past its limit and you could barely breathe anymore? It's very similar to what happens when the liver is weakened for the many reasons we've explored in this book. Can't produce enough bile to efficiently break down radical fats from a variety of food sources, and then is force-fed foreign bile. The ramifications of the liver being low on bile, as bad as you've heard they can be, are not as problematic or damaging as adding bile from another source to the body is. To the liver, ox bile is like an alien creature source, not bio-identical, even if a lab has deemed it compatible enough and called it bio-identical. That lab hasn't researched and discovered the hundreds of other chemical compounds that exist inside an ox's bile that are foreign to our stomach, the rest of our digestive system, and our body. We always have to remember that funding only goes as far as funding goes with any scientific endeavour. For any topic in science, if there were more funding, so much more would be discovered. Space travel, for example, would be light years ahead, so to speak, if there were infinite funding. The more resources allocated to a scientific project, the further along that project goes. Bile is no exception. The reality is that no one is going to put hundreds of millions of dollars into the exploration of bile to find out what chemical compounds exist in another animal's bile that are damaging to the human body. What kind of undiscovered foreign enzymes exist in alien bile that can disrupt the human endocrine system or immune system or central nervous system, or that can be disease-producing, or that can hurt the human liver? That research to protect you isn't going to happen because the money isn't there. Instead, science knows that ox bile is at least the equivalent substance in that animal, and that it contains similar mineral salts, and that's all they need to know to ship it off. What's good for the goose must be good for the gander. In truth, ox bile's concentration is far different from our own bile's concentration, because an animal many times our size and weight is naturally going to produce much stronger bile. Yet bile concentration remains completely unexplored. That alone would take millions of dollars to uncover. Ox bile also contains undiscovered chemical compounds that are different from the chemical compounds our own livers release. Although they're not going to find that and focus on it, because medical research and science don't yet completely understand human bile either. A capsule of ox bile from a reputable source, as small as that pill may be, can shock the liver. If a swimming pool goes for a week with too many swimmers, too many people urinating in it, too much heat, too much rain that dilutes the pool chemicals, and not enough chlorine to begin with, it will grow slightly discoloured and stale. Definitely not safe to drink, and in need of refreshing. As soon as you throw some chlorine shock in the pool, an explosion occurs. That's kind of like the shock that the liver experiences from ox bile. When the liver has grown stagnant and sluggish with loads of toxic heavy metals, pharmaceuticals, solvents, fragrance chemicals, hairspray, hair colour, exhaust fumes from the diesel trucks that have been in front of you when you were driving down the highway, and more, and then you throw an ox bile pill into that mix, there's going to be a little shock. It's not because the ox bile is killing anything off, the way chlorine does. This shock happens because the foreign bile disrupts the balance that the liver is trying to calibrate non-stop for you. It's a critical balance to keep chaos from becoming chronic inside of a toxic liver. This shock is like when you're at work trying to bring together five different parts of a project and a new hire is directed to come in. Grab your computer files and start messing with them in an attempt to help you. When you know what you're doing and you're trying to put it all together, you don't need someone else's help. It throws off your balance and it throws off the balance of the project. That's what it's like for your liver when ox bile enters the scene. Here comes this invading entity to interrupt a process on which the real expert is at work. It breaks the liver's balance. Taking ox bile brings back an old theory that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, that if you have a kidney problem, eating kidney can cure it, that eating animal brain will cure your own brain, that eating heart will cure your heart, that eating liver will cure your liver, and so on. It's in that same category of Dark Ages conventional medicine. Even if the theory that ox bile is an acceptable replacement for human bile proved true, there would be another stumbling block. Figuring out how much ox bile a person should really take. There would be no way to know. It would be total guesswork, because medical research and science don't even know how much of our own human bile is necessary to do the job it needs to do. Again, our own bile and the role it plays are still under-researched. Ox bile contains chemical compounds responsible for chemical functions that do not occur in our own human bodies. It also contains undiscovered amino acids that have no role inside of our own bodies. When you consume ox bile, filled with all of these extras that your body can't use, the extras go from your stomach into and past the duodenum, absorb through the intestinal tract, and head directly through the bloodstream highway up to the liver, meaning that the liver must process this blood filled with foreign ox bile. Why is this bad? Imagine it's like your best friend, whom you care about and have trusted for years. You know each other's stories and secrets. You know everything about each other. Now say you're driving around together and you decide to pull up in front of a cafe. While your friend runs inside to get you both coffee, you wait in the car. Say the person who walks back out, opens the door, jumps in your passenger seat and hands you a cup of coffee is an entirely different person passing herself off as your friend. She looks very similar and says all the right things, and it seems like she could be your confidant until you realize she's really a stranger who knows nothing about who you are, nothing about your dreams and losses, your aspirations, your life story. Along with this, the imposter smells really, really bad. It's an odour you can't put your finger on. It's not the body odour your friend sometimes gets after the gym. It's far worse, mysterious and terrible. It disturbs you so much that you lose your ability to function like you normally would, because you're too busy trying to figure out if this smell is a threat. Is it toxic? Harmful? Do you need to do something about it? You decide to throw your cup of coffee in the garbage, ask this person to leave the car and speed away. As you drive down the road, the smell lingers and you begin to process what just happened. Once you've had a chance to shake out the confusion, you realize you need to go back to the coffee shop where you find your real friend waiting at the curb. "Where have you been all this time?" she asks as she enters the car. When it's forced to absorb ox bile and its chemical compounds that are foreign to the human body, your liver is in the same position you were in when an imposter came out of the coffee shop. When your liver takes on ox bile's extras so you don't get hurt, it's a major confusion to the organ. It has its own bile that it needs to reabsorb later to protect you. Ox bile can push the liver over the edge. The liver loses its focus on what it really needs to do, pick up its real friend, your own natural bile that's been waiting on the curb. When your liver is having trouble producing its own bile, what it really needs instead of ox bile is a glass of celery juice to help restore and heal itself. The liver identifies the proper mineral salts in celery juice and builds them up so it can step up to produce adequate levels of bile. The liver also needs lower dietary fat. When a physician identifies a patient as having minimal bile production, ox bile is usually offered with the goal of that patient continuing to eat plenty of dietary fat. Practically everybody has been on a high-fat diet their entire lives, between grilled cheese sandwiches and chicken Caesar salads and slices of pizza and so much more. The popular mistake is that by taking ox bile, you don't have to moderate that at all. The reality is that the millions of people with diminishing bile production are supposed to adopt low-fat diets, more in keeping with the meal ideas in Chapter 38 and the recipes in Chapter 39, so that the liver gets some alleviation from the normal bombardment of fat that's often labelled as protein. With lower fat, the liver can get a chance to detox and restore its own bile production. Since high-protein eating is so trendy right now, with the world making the mistake that a diet high in fat is the healthiest option, people take the ox bile and eat more fat than ever, never realizing that it's making the problem worse. Eating liver. The practice of eating liver is alive and well for two reasons. One, many people truly love the taste of liver, and two, there's a long-standing belief that eating liver is good for you, particularly beneficial for healing and strengthening the liver itself and for building the blood. People add turkey liver to stuffing, fry up cow and chicken livers for the family, and consider goose and duck livers delicacies, sometimes using them to make the popular dish foie gras. That eating liver is good for your health is far from true. When we think about it, in light of what your own liver does for your own body, what it does and what it's for, we can easily see that this is a sad, misled misconception. First of all, it's rare to almost impossible to find a truly clean, healthy liver on planet Earth, whether human or animal. If we did find a beautifully healthy liver from a creature raised in a pure, pristine environment, it would still be filled with toxins collected from that animal's own body. Normal bodily functions create toxins that the liver must process and store. While it's easy to think that a bear or deer raised in a remote forest on wild game, grasses, or other plants would have the cleanest liver possible, that's not the case. Wild animals are constantly in fight or flight mode, which means they constantly release fear-based adrenaline. Just like us, their livers must act as sponges to absorb all of that excess stress hormone. The liver isn't only a sponge for the toxic, though. What could seem like a great healing benefit of eating liver is how incredible the liver is altogether. This amazing, powerful glandular organ holds and processes important enzymes, trace minerals, amino acids, antioxidants, and other phytochemicals, so it does make incredible logical sense to say that consuming liver could help you out. Listening to this audiobook, learning about all of its miraculous chemical functions and compounds, you may even be thinking now more than ever, would I benefit from eating liver? Would another liver's strength enter my own? The answer is yes. You probably could benefit in some way, surprisingly or not. Yet this shouldn't automatically lead to the belief that people need liver, because there's another side to it. The precious nutrients that the liver holds are like a massive hoard of rare gold coins, emeralds, diamonds, and other priceless treasures buried deep within the earth. You have the tools to dig them up, only something lies on top: radioactive nuclear waste. Chances are you'll get to the treasure trove just fine, though. You'll live a very short life with those gems and jewels in your hands. You won't get to enjoy your invaluable finds, because they came with poison. That's the reality of what the liver contains, both treasure and troublemakers. It's like being given a tonic that has the power to make you live forever, mixed with poison that takes it all away. We also run into the same issue raised by ox bile supplementation. What's contained in an animal's liver is not going to be compatible with the human body. The goodies stored in an animal liver will not match up with how our livers work. Animal livers produce and store animal enzymes and animal chemical compounds signature to their individual species identities. Each one is tailored to the miraculous physical body of that specific creature. They can't be re-identified, tagged, reshaped, and used by our own human bodies. The exception is fat. If there's fat inside an animal liver, we can use that. Trouble is, that fat probably harbours plenty of poison, because fat cells in the liver store toxins. Out of everything else in that animal's liver, it's possible our liver can use some trace minerals or maybe, if we're lucky, a few antioxidants. They're not enough to balance the toxic load. Ultimately, your liver must process and store those poisons, as well as the unusable animal-specific chemical compounds, and that contributes to your organs' overload. If you wanted to receive the goodies a liver has the potential to offer, you'd have to eat a human liver. Of course, I wouldn't recommend it. Besides, any treasure in a human liver would be buried under waste too. A plethora of toxic heavy metals, solvents, drugs, prescribed and recreational, plastics, mystery chemicals, viruses, bacteria, radiation, DDT, and its cousins, that is, all pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides, and the like. The bad would far outweigh the good. Believe me, it wouldn't be worth cannibalism. While we can laugh about cannibalism here, the truth is that a common practice in conventional medicine 150 years ago was to consume human body parts in various forms. Alternative medicine of the day was against this conventional theory, not to mention the secret black market practice of selling bodies, one of the darker sides of science in the past. One method of consumption was to soak human bones in water, creating a tonic much like today's animal bone broth. Another was to eat pieces of human skin to heal a skin condition, and to eat parts of other human organs to strengthen those organs in a living person. This secret custom was born out of that Dark Ages theory we looked at in Oxbile, of healing a human body part with an animal's corresponding body part. It's why we still carry the belief that we can benefit the liver by eating liver. It's also why some supplements today contain little bits of animal organs and glands with the idea that they'll help your own organs and glands. This thought process is hundreds and hundreds of years old and has never healed anyone. And yet, it has survived to this day. For your own protection, take your cue from predators in the wild. When they eat an animal they've caught, they'll avoid eating the liver. It's the last-ditch organ that animals go for, usually left for scavengers and creatures pushed to starvation. Those animals forced to eat liver will end up eating more wild shoots and roots in the spring to cleanse their own livers of what intoxicated them. There's an instinctive, innate reason for these animal behaviours. We would do well to heed that instinct too. Liver flushes. Liver flushes always sound catchy. They seem like a perfect, easy answer to clean up and clear out. Well, they are catchy, in that there's a catch. Liver flushes are man-made theories of protocols that people think should work for the organ. Thinking for the liver is kind of like thinking for someone else. Do you like it if someone puts words in your mouth? Probably not. Especially if it's about a specific, sensitive subject that could in some way alter the outcome of your life. When it comes down to it, I can't state this enough. Forced liver cleansing comes with a price. If this gets you irritated, I understand. You could be someone who loves your liver flushes. I respect that. At the same time, I'm here to bring you guidance. That's my job, to look out for you. It's not the end of the world if you've been doing liver flushes. What you need to know is that the liver has an existence of its own that we don't rule over. It runs on its own time. If your boss kept you at work until midnight when you were supposed to leave at 5 to pick up your daughter from band rehearsal, you wouldn't appreciate that infringement, would you? And if you were having a normal Sunday off, when with no notice whatsoever, you were expected to drop your bagel on the plate, stop making pancakes for your kid, get dressed, and rush to work while watching other people in their cars getting to run their weekend errands, and then you were expected to stay as late as it took to finish the project, even if that meant not getting to leave until 2 a.m, that wouldn't fit with your life either, right? And then say that at the same time that you were being forced to meet these extra scheduling demands, you were also expected to produce volumes of work every hour on the hour, more results than ever before in your career. Does this remind you of something? Is it anything like a liver flush, forcing it to cleanse on an unnatural schedule against its will, while you check the toilet hourly for theoretical make-believe liver stones? More on liver stones in a moment. There are a lot of different liver cleansers out there. Some are for the liver only. some are for the liver and gallbladder, some are just aimed for the gallbladder. They are all liver pushers. When you have a child and that child starts to grow up, what's one of the greatest threats you fear? That your child will run into a drug pusher? We never want a child's own will and potential to be overpowered by a force that doesn't have her or his best interests at heart. We should feel just as protective of our livers. You get a lot more cleansing work done with your liver and gallbladder when you go with the grain, not against it. If you try to go against it with flushes and cleanses that aren't balanced, your liver will outsmart you every time. Think you're smarter than your liver? No way. You'll never be smarter than your liver. Not that you aren't an intelligent person. I'm not trying to break your confidence in who you are. It's just that none of us are going to outsmart our livers. They won't let us get away with anything. They cannot be controlled. The liver is a programmer, a think tank all on its own. If you push it, it pushes back and performs less. If you push more, it performs even less. If you keep pushing hard, it throws itself into shutdown mode, running on backup battery, waiting for you to stop messing around with it. It stops cleansing altogether in order to try to normalize and seek homeostasis. Not until you finally stop does it take a breath and go back to actual normal functioning. Does this remind you of anything in your life? You push it too hard, it resists, so you have to finesse it. This concept applies in so many situations. Your liver holds ancient information from long before you were born. Remember, it also holds data about your life that you don't even remember. It senses all your crafty tricks because it's had to save your butt from one episode after another, like when you gobbled a greasy cheeseburger or chugged a quart of beer at a college party. It uses this memory in order to protect you. It knows if you've been bad or good, naughty or nice. It knows if you've tried to flush a boatload of toxins all at once. In our human minds, we just think, get it all out at once. We think these flushes send all the toxins out through the intestinal tract and kidneys so that everything ends up in the toilet and we can say goodbye. The liver knows better. When it's a flush done wrong, one that pushes the liver hard against its will, the bloodstream is where those toxins end up. The liver knows, even though we're not aware, that all these poisons entering the blood at once put the heart and brain under direct threat. An onslaught of toxic sludge and debris headed for our heart valves and ventricles is not the liver's idea of an ideal vacation method. It could cause erratic heartbeats, stress on the heart, inflammation, elevated adrenaline, and electrical confusion of the heart, all while we're busy looking for stones in the toilet. By the way, those stones aren't stones at all. They're fatty globules from these oil-filled flushes. The excess olive oil in the colon coagulates and forms jelly balls, which are then expelled and, I'm sorry to say, in many cases, mistaken for hundreds of stones. I hope this doesn't upset you as a listener. You deserve to know the truth, that they're evidence of your body trying to save you from all that oil. See the next myth for more. Let's also touch on flushing the gallbladder for a moment. In chapter 34, you heard that oil-based flushes aren't the best practice for removing gallstones either. Over the years, I've seen too many cases of people pushing gallstones into the bile duct and requiring emergency surgery. There's a better way of getting rid of gallstones, and that's to dissolve them, which we already discussed. And there's a better way to cleanse the liver, one that works with it, not against it, and ends up being more effective than any man-made protocol. We'll get to that in Chapter 38. Liver stones. While you may hear that the liver can produce its own stones, it's not possible. There are cases where the duct leading from the gallbladder to the intestinal tract gets clogged with stones. Those are gallstones, and they're different from the mistaken theory of liver stones. There are no cases of the hepatic ducts inside the liver getting clogged with stones, so-called liver stones, because the liver does not pass already formed stones through the ducts that lead bile to the gallbladder. The liver is too hot for a stone to forge there. Stones are forged in the gallbladder itself, through the process we examined in Chapter 32, with toxins and poisons moving from the hot liver into the cool gallbladder. The liver's heat is actually a mechanism that protects you from stones forming there, whether hard or soft. If stones did form within it, the liver wouldn't be able to pass them through the bile. The hepatic ducts in the liver that carry bile are not as big as anybody believes. Only if you were a surgeon well-versed in dissecting the bile duct system in human livers would you have a sense of how thin they are. They can't support stones passing through them, much less the very large liver stones that people believe they can eliminate during a cleanse. The liver can't send a stone out of a hepatic vein either, because it would instantly cause a blood clot or heart attack. There's no way for your liver to get a stone safely to your feces to be eliminated. If stones really were forming inside the liver, they'd be getting stuck in the hepatic ducts, and people with sick, toxic livers would be in total agony. Hospitals would be filled with millions of people requiring emergency liver stone removal surgery, and there would be a very popular surgery method for it, since surgery is one area where modern medicine excels. It would be just as common, if not more so, than kidney stone surgery. If someone does a liver flush and sees stones in the toilet, it's really food and debris from the intestinal tract mixed with the oil from the concoctions that go with the cleanse. What about if someone is doing a liver cleanse that doesn't involve any olive oil flushing and is even entirely fat-free? There are still going to be bits and pieces of food waste coming off the walls of the intestinal linings, mixed with the large quantities of herbal mixtures someone is usually ingesting for a cleanse, and they can be expelled together with mucus from the digestive tract, so that in the toilet you think you're seeing liver stones when you're not. The liver stone flushing trend has taken on a life of its own, even though many professionals in the field of healing are unaware of how the liver truly works. No one's perfect, not even practitioners and healers. We all make mistakes. The key now is to pick yourself up off the ground, dust yourself off, and get it right. Don't be afraid of moving past something that turned out to be wrong, even though you once believed in it. Fructose intolerance. If you buy into the fructose intolerance and malabsorption myth, you'll get cheated out of healing your liver. The confusion around fructose intolerance has everything to do with the liver. The more toxic your liver is, the more it may appear to someone that you're fructose intolerant, when in reality, you're not fructose intolerant at all. Lactose, dairy sugar, and fructose are entirely different animals. For example, viruses and bacteria throughout the body feverishly feed off lactose from dairy, just as they do with gluten. When someone has a high bacterial or viral load that's going undiagnosed, and these pathogens feed off gluten, that person can wind up with an intestinal disorder diagnosis, such as celiac. In reality, Celiac isn't the body attacking itself. It's pathogens attacking the body. Dairy's lactose feeds pathogens as well, which can worsen symptoms and conditions of all kinds. Just because bacterial or viral activity in your body can make you gluten or lactose intolerant, that doesn't mean you can be fructose intolerant. Fructose shouldn't be lumped in with lactose just because they're two forms of sugar. Fructose does not feed pathogens. It's impossible for any test in any lab or clinic to separate out fructose and know what it specifically does inside the body, whether negative or positive. Theoretical testing for fructose intolerance has never been accurate and most likely never will be, because it's backed by a belief system that is biased against fruit. The fructose intolerant label is part of the anti-healthy carb, anti-fruit movement that robs people of the very food that can help them heal from chronic conditions. The liver desperately needs fruit sugar to restore itself and defend itself from pathogens. Because fruit is so purifying, someone who consumes fruit is going to cleanse and detox more than with any other food. And that leads to a common mistake when evaluating for fructose intolerance. Often people who are chronically sick and have sluggish, stagnant, sick livers react when they start detoxing with a mildly or more heavily. One apple can cleanse your liver in more ways than anyone realizes, and all those poisons leaving can cause detox reactions and symptoms that confuse both patient and practitioner, especially if the overall diet is not geared to cleansing. Almost all practitioners who fall prey to the belief system of fructose intolerance also believe in high-fat diets, regardless of the fancy name or branding given to them. Even elimination diets, where certain foods are experimented with to see if they cause a reaction, making it feel for people like they're custom-made, remain high-fat diets. With a diet high in fat, the blood stays toxic and the liver stays toxic. And when someone eats fruit, which cleanses and detoxes the liver, those poisons have nowhere to go because the blood is so filled with fats and toxins. The resulting reactions are inevitably branded as fructose intolerance or malabsorption, keeping people away from what could really offer help. They only get to experience some relief of symptoms temporarily, not long-term healing. Another big part of what people believe to be fructose intolerance is insulin resistance, which you heard about in Chapter 2, Your Adaptogenic Liver, and in Chapter 15, Diabetes and Blood Sugar Imbalance. When someone doesn't understand insulin resistance as having too much fat in the blood and a toxic, stagnant liver, fructose intolerance can get blamed. Now, there's a distinction made between fructose intolerance, often called hereditary fructose intolerance, HFI, and fructose malabsorption. In neither case is the concept or the testing accurate. With HFI, it's not really genetic. The ALDOB gene and a deficiency of the aldolase B isoenzyme have nothing to do with the symptoms someone may experience from eating a piece of fruit. First of all, no one is completely missing the aldolase B isoenzyme. Secondly, when it is lowered, it's just one among dozens of other enzymes and hundreds of chemical functions that are not even on medical research and science's radar that diminish when the liver is dysfunctional. By focusing on aldolase B and attributing its deficiency to fructose issues, experts fall into the trap of not allowing you to eat the very food that would bring your stagnant, sluggish liver back to health, which would allow aldolase B and all those other enzymes and chemical functions to restore themselves. HFI is just a theory, which is why we're talking about it here in the myths chapter. And by the way, a very small proportion of people actually react when eating fruit. It's more common to react to sweeteners such as table sugar. Symptoms that seem to come from eating fruit have everything to do with fat intolerance, which comes from a dysfunctional liver. The HFI label is a bait and switch made to make you think fruit sugar is the problem while industries protect fats. Remember, everything that's not understood is blamed on genes, and if you go down that path, you'll be cheated out of the very solution that will help you heal your liver so you can become symptom-free. With fructose malabsorption, experts believe that testing picks up on excess fructose in your system, meaning that you're not able to absorb it. What they don't understand is that you're really experiencing an intestinal tract filled with rancid fat that's not being broken down due to a weak, sluggish, stagnant, dysfunctional, sick, probably pre-fatty liver that needs attention. When you put a piece of fruit in your gut, it's going to trigger off a malabsorption test, both because the fruit sugar has nowhere to go, since the digestive tract is lined with hardened, putrid fats, and because the fruit is trying to cleanse your gut and heal your liver. Practitioners will see your test reaction as fruit not working for you, and they'll keep recommending lots of animal protein as your main calorie source, the very factor that lowered your bile reserves over the years to begin with, causing fats to go rancid and stick to the linings of your small intestine and colon. If people reduced their intake of fats, in turn minimizing their blood fat ratio, they wouldn't be symptomatic anymore when eating fruit, nor would they trigger off tests for fructose issues, because there was never a fructose intolerance or malabsorption issue to begin with. Their livers would start healing, strengthening, and functioning better. Fruit would be able to offer even more benefit, and they would start getting better, regardless of the HFI or fructose malabsorption diagnosis they had received. Those who design high-fat diets are starting to wake up to the truth that incorporating more plant foods gets people better results. And these fancily named new diets are by default starting to contain lower fats. The next step in healing won't occur until people move past their fruit fear and start adding more than a green apple and a handful of berries to their day. Lectin concern. Another popular trend that's on the rise is the concern that certain foods are high in lectins and therefore have a negative effect on health. You have to understand that for decades, there have been chronically sick people, and for decades to come, there will be chronically sick people. When someone knows what's wrong with her or his body, knows what's causing a symptom or condition, and knows how to heal it, she or he can heal it. Over dozens of years, I've witnessed tens of thousands of people do just this, recover their health, even from the most devastating conditions. These recoveries had nothing to do with lectin concern. We can't live in a bubble where we believe that nobody got better from what ailed them until the lectin trend came along. The promoters of lectin literature and studies have been completely in the dark about the thousands and thousands of people who have healed without their trendy misinformation. It's as if they've ignored people's healing because it doesn't fit into their box of what they believed. They pretend that no one has ever healed from chronic illness so that they can build their lectins empire. This is a prime example of entitled ignorance. The problem with lectin concern is that it removes foods that would actually stop the viruses and other pathogens in people's bodies that truly cause symptoms and disease. Lectin leaders don't know about these pathogens, or don't know their role in causing conditions and illnesses such as EBV as the true cause of RA. They would rather think a potato is causing someone's RA than discover the truth that an amino acid in potatoes, L-lysine, stops EBV from causing RA. Instead, they believe that autoimmune is the immune system attacking the body's own cells and destroying itself. Since they don't understand that this autoimmune theory is inaccurate, they have nowhere else to turn besides blaming it all on lectins, believing in part that lectins are a problem because they supposedly confuse the body and cause it to turn against itself. Meanwhile, they remove the foods that can heal you, such as fruit and certain vegetables, roots and tubers, leading you to eat more fats and hurt your liver. The lectins in fruits and vegetables do not harm us. Please don't let any source confuse you into thinking that lectins are like the toxic alkaloids produced as a defense mechanism by some wild plants, not fit for human consumption. There are shoots and twigs and other plants that, if a deer takes a bite of them, surface alkaloids to repel that deer and other animals and insects from damaging them further. We already don't eat those foods because we know they're toxic to us, and lectins aren't even what makes them a problem. Garden variety fruits and vegetables, and even the wild plants we know to be edible, are in a whole different category. Yet, they're being lumped together with problematic alkaloid-containing plants. Again, the lectins in the foods we eat do not cause harm. There are certain proteins that aren't in fruits and vegetables and are in items such as dairy, eggs, and certain grains, including wheat, that do feed pathogens, creating inflammation. Lectins aren't one of them. As you'll hear in Chapter 36, Liver Troublemakers, dairy, eggs, and some grains are worth treating warily. There are dozens of proteins and compounds in dairy, eggs, and wheat for experts to hang dozens of hats on in their quest to alleviate chronic illness, and yet they try to hang their hat on the one that's not a problem, lectins. It's ironic. Yes, be concerned about gluten-rich foods. No, don't be afraid of potatoes and fresh ripe tomatoes. I've watched them heal even the sickest people. I've even recently seen potatoes save some lives. Look out for anti-lectin sentiment and be cautious about buying into it. This trendy mistake is going to continue to create confusion with healing into the future. It's another anti-fruit campaign, another biased design to stop you from eating the fruits that heal your liver and body, another excuse for medical research and science's lack of knowledge about what causes chronic illness. Please don't let it rob you and your children of what you need to heal along the way. Apple cider vinegar. Apple cider vinegar, ACV, has been getting extra acclaim these days for being good for the stomach and the rest of the digestive tract. With the gut, it's thought to create alkalinity, settle acid reflux, and help with bloating. It's getting even more acclaim for cleansing the gallbladder and liver. Apples in themselves are miracles. They're amazing for digestion. They collect and rid bacteria, parasites, viruses, and mold from the entire gut. They create a stable alkaline environment wherever needed. They also help heal diverticulitis and reduce inflammation in the stomach and intestinal tract. Apples are incredibly cleansing and healing for the gallbladder and liver. Not only do they detoxify, carefully extracting sediment from these organs, they also help dissolve gallstones. mind you, these are apples we're talking about, not apple cider vinegar. Apple cider is very helpful for all of the above, not apple cider vinegar. Apple juice is extremely helpful for everything I just mentioned, not ACV. Applesauce is great for all of it too, though not ACV. Apple cider vinegar does not create alkalinity or cleanse your system. Apples do. You know that saying, you take the bad with the good. Usually what we mean is that we know there are going to be some downsides to the positives in life. And whatever bad we end up going through, the good is enough to support it. It's half and half, give or take, or hopefully the good even outweighs the bad. That's why it's a somewhat positive viewpoint. Whatever bad comes with the good, it's at least an equal exchange. With ACV, there's some good. There's a lot of bad, and it does not come out to an even 50-50. The good comes from amino acids, minerals, trace minerals, phytochemicals, and other nutrients from the apples used to make it. If the vinegar was fermented and stored properly and contains mother in it, meaning living microorganisms, then at least it provides some nutrition, although the living mother won't be alive much longer after entering the stomach. Even the mildest hydrochloric acid can knock the life out of these microorganisms. Look, ACV is the healthiest vinegar to use if you're a vinegar lover. If you can't live without a little vinegar on your salad, ACV is the one to pick. So if I know it's the best vinegar, and I love apples for what they do for us, why am I not a big advocate of ACV? The reason I have a problem with ACV is the same reason everyone has a problem with any vinegar, whether they know it or not. Because if there's one thing our livers despise, it's vinegar. If your liver had a voice, it would shout that to the heavens. The liver hates vinegar as much as it hates alcohol. With alcohol, the liver gets slowly drunk and dysfunctional. With vinegar, the liver becomes disabled in a different way. The liver cells struggle to stay balanced and perform as they fight for oxygen, because vinegar steals oxygen from the bloodstream and the liver like a thief in the night. Some people seem to heal a sore throat with ACV, and in truth, many more people get a sore throat from ACV. Some people relieve bloating with ACV, and many more people get extremely bloated from ACV. Some people relieve acid reflux from ACV, and many more people get the worst acid reflux attack they've ever had from ACV. Some people relieve gallbladder pain with ACV, and many more people get a really bad gallbladder attack from ACV. Still, the bad outweighs the good, even when it seems like ACV is helping one problem. That's because, out of sight, the liver pays a price. Basically, when we consume vinegar, the liver battles being pickled like a cucumber. Now, it takes salt and vinegar to make a pickle. Your raw, organic ACV with mother in it most likely doesn't come with added sodium. Salt ends up being added to the vinegar, though, as the ACV enters your bloodstream and liver. In order to survive, we need a level of sodium in the blood, so our blood is slightly salty, like a living ocean is salty. Some of the sodium is from uncharted avenues, including the microtrace mineral salts we get from consuming the right foods, such as celery. The liver also stores a certain amount of sodium. One of its chemical functions is to release sodium in times of dire need in order to keep enough sodium in the bloodstream. So even if we don't eat salt along with our vinegar, there's just enough salt in the organs glands and blood to mix with the vinegar as we consume it. As a result of the vinegar-sodium reaction, a pickling process occurs. One could argue that this isn't the type of pickling that happens when someone is preserving a vegetable in a jar to last through the winter. Still, it is a variety of pickling that happens internally. Eating one salad with ACV dressing is not the worst thing that can happen to the liver. It can add up, though. If you're using ACV in a flush or taking tablespoons of it daily because it's supposed to be good for you, the liver will be affected by the long-term volume and it will eventually retaliate. Before an apple was turned into vinegar, it was neutral to alkaline. When you eat an apple, it can drive the stomach and intestinal tract to a higher level of alkalinity without disturbing the stomach's neutralization zone. That is, its balancing of everything that enters it before it moves on to the duodenum and the rest of the intestinal tract. Your stomach can be alkaline and still have a very strong blend of hydrochloric acid. Your stomach is not just one environment. An apple is expected in the stomach. It was one of the very first foods bestowed upon humankind for us to consume. It's a powerful earned reward for the liver. Have you ever worked hard in your life, whether on a project, task, generosity, charity, or on the vital endeavor of keeping yourself afloat and rewarded yourself with an experience you knew you'd love? Maybe that was a day off, a drive to the beach, a walk in the park. An apple is the liver's great reward for all the work it's doing. Unlike an apple, ACV, like any vinegar, comes into the stomach extremely acidic. The liver must put a halt to it immediately and use its every reserve to try to alkalize or at least neutralize it. The ACV fights back, and its acidic nature is so strong that the stomach loses the battle many times over. Instead of alkalizing your gut, it does the opposite. It weakens hydrochloric acid and breaks down gastric juices and heads down the pike, still acidic. It's basically an assault on the stomach and intestinal tract. At first, as the vinegar pushes its way through the plumbing, the liver starts to become a little hysterical. Soon after, the liver gets a quick shot of acidosis. Although it's temporary, it's just long enough to stun it. Like a friend smacking you across the face to snap you out of what he interprets to be a hysterical moment. Is ACV all bad? No. There's much worse out there. Here's the important point. ACV is far from a liver cleansing or intestinal tonic. It's not a miracle food. Apple sauce is a healing miracle food for the liver and gallbladder. ACV, along with other vinegar tonics, it's an insult to the liver. I know there's a big fermented foods movement out there, and people really enjoy them. The truth here has nothing to do with what you or I like, though. It's about what your liver would like. Your liver has needs. Do you write a needs list every day? I need to do this. I need to get that. I need to have that. Well, the liver has a needs list, too. And fermented foods, ACV and vinegar of any kind are not on it. Just as the liver is a storehouse, we can collect a lot of items in our lives. To keep our closets from overflowing, we'll try to turn down whatever we can before it ever enters our home. I don't need a pair of skates right now. I've got plenty of beach towels. Don't need a new one. No thanks. I already have an electric toothbrush. I don't need those smelly candles. Thanks anyway. If your liver could opt out of ACV like this, it would. The liver doesn't need ACV. At least with ACV's popularity, people are thinking Apple. If your liver could speak, every visit to the natural foods store would be like a game of charades. As you walked toward the ACV aisle, your liver would be saying, "You're close, you're close. The word Apple is on the bottle. That part is right." When you picked up the bottle, it would shout, "No, close but no cigar. Try again." And when you were wandering past produce, skipping all the fruit because your trendy high-fat diet said to avoid it, your liver would be calling out to you, "Stop, stop, get the apples." In every way other than fermented, the apple is a true powerhouse and miracle for well-being. Everything being said, if you want to partake in some ACV, fine. It is the best out of all the vinegars, a little here and there as a dressing on a special dish, if you really want it, could be okay. Many people don't use much of it to begin with, and as a condiment, it is healthier than most. It has those nutrients in it because of the apple, thank God. As far as using ACV in larger amounts to cleanse the liver goes, though, know that it's a myth. If it's liver healing you want, skip the shots of ACV and reach instead for some unfermented apples. Coffee enemas. Coffee enemas are a popular, long-standing liver remedy commonly used for pancreatic, colon, and other cancers, as well as a general alternative healing avenue for just about any sickness. Coffee enemas are even hyped as a maintenance method for people who are already healthy to stay that way. They're not just a part of alternative medicine anymore, either. Their popularity has spread to conventional medicine as well. A coffee enema's theoretical function is to purge toxins from the liver, allowing the body to heal. It's a perfectly reasoned claim. Detoxing the liver does help you heal. Here's where we start to run into trouble. To begin with, coffee is strong, harsh, extremely acidic, dehydrating, highly astringent, and overstimulating. It's a drug. Remember, you can get addicted to it, and that's part of what has made people so attached to it as an enema tonic for healing. All of those challenges of coffee can be okay for the individual who likes to drink a cup of it. Coffee entering the stomach is a whole different story than coffee entering directly into the colon through an enema. Our stomachs are geared to handle a brew. It may not be perfect for our stomachs. Coffee does have the ability to challenge the stomach environment, its pH, its hydrochloric acid levels, though this can be fine for the people with stomach tolerance. It also has the potential to be hard on the nervous system